Welcome to Bookwaves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Richard Powers, whose latest novel is Orfeo. Earlier novels include The Echo Maker, The Time of Our Singing, Galatea 2.0. There are 11 novels in all. Plus, there are some essays on your website. Richard Powers is a unique author. He combines physics, music, several other elements in all of his books. This book, Orfeo, seems to have arisen from the story of someone named Steve Kurtz, a performance artist and bio artist who was arrested in 2004 by Homeland Security. Is that correct?
That's right. Kurtz worked with biological materials for installation pieces at major museums across the country and internationally. And he was working on such a project when the death of his wife brought police attention to him, and their discovery of materials in and around his home triggered concern. This was, you know, two years after the 9/11 attacks. And despite the fact that Kurtz was immediately able to demonstrate that he had an exhibition coming up that would justify this materials in any way that any reasonable law enforcement officer could ask, he was not entirely released and cleared of all charges for another 4 years. So my discovery of this story led me to a deep interest in what it feels like to live in a culture of fear.
At what point did you discover this? Was it after you'd written Generosity?
No, it was before. So I've been living with this story for some years and living with this notion that, you know, really if you want to tell a story of contemporary America, something about this culture of fear has got to be front and center. I guess it was after or while Generosity, which was published in 2009, my 10th novel, appeared, that I began to develop interests, one in music. I had read Alex Ross's tremendous history of 20th century music, The Rest is Noise, and I have written about music in the past. I myself am an avid instrumentalist and something of an amateur composer, so I thought, hey, you know, this might be an interesting career for somebody who might have slightly less valid reason for having these materials around the house and therefore keep this drama of artistic expression versus the security state a little more dramatic through the initial confusion and into the showdown. So that's what brought me back to the Kurt story. And combining those two together gave me a chance to actually tell the flip side of the story of the culture of fear and talk a little bit about the fear of culture and create an avant-garde composer who has spent his entire life, he's 71 when the book opens, pursuing a kind of music that valorized confrontation, subversion, the challenge of expectation and discomfort as a form of expression, if you will, which when this composer was a young man was actually in its heyday in the 60s and 70s, music of a very challenging nature. And have him as an older man begin to wonder whether he has devoted his life to the wrong horse, as it were, and setting him on a kind of last hurrah, a kind of form of music that might once again be somehow troubling or fear-inducing in a way that's expressive, setting him on this collision course with the forces of safety and security allowed me to tell the story of a man who has to reevaluate his entire life and decide whether or not to recommit to those artistic values that started him out as a young man.
You've chosen, Richard Powers, to put this in a parallel narrative. We have the narrative of his history combined with what's happening with him as he deals with the issues involving Homeland Security. You've done this before in books like Gain and Plowing the Dark. Is this a kind of template that you enjoy working with?
Well, the template is different every time out. The 11 novels do explore the uses of multiple narrative frames, sometimes dealing with the same cast of characters and sometimes dealing with entirely different milieu and weaving them contrapuntally, if you will, to create different kinds of narrative effects. This one is actually one of the tamer in terms of the formal devices used in the book. It's not uncommon to see books where there is a salient present-day story that presents the door to which the central protagonist is allowed to go back to time travel into his past and explore the crucial moments of his own life and the mistakes and the battles that he has fought. The reason for this form this time around is it's a very analogical musical device. I'm writing a kind of fugue about this 71-year-old man who has to somehow make good to the four other central protagonists in his life, his ex-wife, his dear friend, his daughter, and so on. So the creation of this structure where he's living this sort of catastrophic crisis in a short period of time over the course of just several days in the present, intercut with the full 70 years of his life and a chance to kind of take that hard look at the composition that he has created by writing his own life.
In that sense, the New York Times review of the book, which says that the book is kind of structured with four movements as if it were a musical composition, is pretty accurate then.
I wouldn't call it four movements because they're not sequential. They're actually woven through each other. So, yeah, I'll stick with this metaphor of the fugue or counterpoint.
Inside the counterpoint are all of these tweets.
Not to give away too much, but yes, there is a device that I hope will seem mysterious and compelling to readers when they first open up the book and reveals itself through the course of the story to be a kind of extended meditation, another artwork, if you will, that Peter Else, the composer, adds on as a kind of farewell to the audience that he never had until he stopped looking for it and then found it in an unexpected place in the form of this national attention.
Richard Powers, the character of Peter Ells, I understand in an interview, a fabulous interview from Powell Books, which people can find online. Jill Owens was the interviewer. She talks a little bit that this is almost an alternate universe version of Richard Powers if you would become a composer. Is that correct?
You know, I did toy with the idea of making music composition my central form of expression when I was a young man. So I guess there is a kind of road not taken quality to this book. And the beautiful thing about being a novelist is you can, for a period of 3, 4, 5 years, live all of these hypothetical lives that you didn't pursue in real life, and to try to get a feel of the way that the world would seem to somebody who did commit to that profession. And I've done that with different scientific disciplines, too, in some of the other books. But, yes, I can't call it a Romana Clay, per se. I mean, this guy is a generation older than I am.
Why did you do that, by the way?
I wanted to be able to write with a long lens about avant-garde music in America. So I had to make the guy old enough to have him be on the ramparts when these battles were being fought, these kind of aesthetic showdowns and the desire to open up the vocabulary of music, to create kinds of music that the ear doesn't know how to hear yet. So to do that, I had to make him a reasonable age. He's born in 1940, which is an incredibly momentous time, not only for world history, but for music. And he comes of age in the 60s, where everyone was listening to other voices in other rooms. And he does live long enough to see a kind of retrenchment of musical aesthetic, to see the kinds of fights that he had aligned himself with as a young man dismissed as mistakes, terrible alienations of the audience, the wrong turn that led to a widespread estrangement from music, and the return of a kind of neo-romanticism, the kind of music that he loved as a young man and had to set aside in order to be fashionable and current and on board with the most progressive musical forces of his young adulthood. And so in order to see the revolution come and go, another revolution, replace that revolution with the discredited paradigm that he began his life with, he needed to be a sufficient age.
But at the same time, this is still your alternate self in that way.
Well, I guess I have to admit that in many ways he is. Of course, the novelist is constantly doing that anyway, that many of the central characters or the favorite characters of the novelist are composites that include large components of their own experience and their own need or desire to see the world in a certain way.
Is there a piece of you then that's thinking, you know, if I were 15 years older, I would have experienced that? I mean, do you feel you almost missed out on that generation's high point?
Well, I think a lot of people who were born in the late 50s and were old enough to get a sense of, you know, there's something happening here, you know, what it is ain't exactly clear, you know, that sense of the times they are a-changing. And yet we're not quite old enough to participate in it. And by the time we came into our own adulthood, I had this tremendous feeling of the glory days being replaced by something much tamer and much more narcissistic and self-serving in a way. That's a gross exaggeration, but I think it's something that we feel, people of a certain age, that we caught a glimpse of a culture that truly was in transformation, truly did believe that we could become something else, and didn't quite get a chance to help further that.
It's a generation of disappointment in a way.
Well, I guess we put our energies into other things and we witnessed other incredible transformations. I mean, by the same token, I feel myself extremely lucky to have been a young man at the beginning of the digital revolution and to witness the total transformation of the world and to be able to participate in that, you know, as a first-hand member of that particular revolution.
But it also means, Richard Powers, that if you wanted to talk about anything about the digital revolution, it would be about the recognition and creation of patterns, zeros and ones building up into something else. And in fact, that's almost a metaphor for your own work as a novelist, I think.
Yeah, and I guess I can come back to your original question about how much my imaginary composer, Peter Elson, in Orfeo, is my alter ego. And I'd say that the fight that he's fighting to produce a kind of transcendental music that's new and unheard, and yet at the same time to create something that would be recognizable to a listener, familiar enough to be engageable, that constant tension between make it new, innovate, take chances, produce something disturbing or subverting that people will learn how to hear, on the one hand, and on the other hand, give them something that they can recognize as belonging to their own innermost needs and their ear that knows how to listen and how to hear things. That tension between the conventional and the revolutionary has characterized my life as a writer. I published my first book in 1985, and I have tried numerous kinds of experiments along the way and have tried to incorporate, as you said in your introduction, lots of material that most people think isn't really the domain of the conventional or the familiar or the reassuring novel. But I've tried to do that in a way that seduces the reader or gives enough of the romance of the self trying to make its way in the world, the traditional concerns of domestic fiction, and to make a thing that somehow is both unfamiliar, new, different, disturbing, but also identifiable, moving in the way that conventional fiction is. Not all the experiments have come off. If you live long and you take a variety of chances and get a chance to try to reinvent yourself a few times over the course of decades, you're going to have hits and misses. But I think in that sense it was a great pleasure to create Peter Elson, a composer who puts his heart and soul into a variety of musics, sees various kinds of fashions come and go, sees the prevailing aesthetic of one moment be completely repudiated and replaced by music of another moment. And to have him actually take that hard look as an old man and look back and say, what do I believe in? What did I need to do? Is it possible to bring these two incommensurable, you know, competing things into the same form of expression? That was a great pleasure. And to some extent, I think that there's a sort of emotional charge to this central character that's very personal for me. And to give him some of my life's mistakes, to invent plentiful and colorful other ones that I can't take responsibility for, was a very cathartic thing for me.
You're listening to an interview with Richard Powers, whose latest novel is Orfeo. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves. There is a sense in a lot of writers, as they talk about their work, that it's the process of discovery kind of bubbling up from the unconscious. Yet at the same time, there's got to be a great deal of control given the themes that you're working with. Do you find these two elements contrary to each other? Do they work with each other? How does it work for you?
Well, that's interesting because in some ways the tension that you've just put your finger on between the sort of Apollonian structuring, the kind of thematic and artistic control colliding with and bumping up against the spontaneous, emotional, Dionysian frenzy of character creation and world creation, that's not dissimilar to the tension that I just described between this sort of desire for innovation, strangeness, difference, but also tapping into continuity, legacy, recognizable tradition. It's not exactly the same, but that tension between the heart and the head, I think, characterizes all artistic creation. And I have come at this question in different ways over the course of my 30 years now, of almost 30 years of writing novels. And I find that what helps most of all in reconciling the need to have a formal coherence but also powerful emotional dynamism is to be confident in the compositional part of making a long story. That a lot of stuff is going to come out in the wash of revision. That when you start a book, you're likely to be living with that book for years. And you won't know what you're doing at first. There's a great line, Theodore Rethke, from a great film, Nell of his, we learn by going where we have to go. You simply have to write your way toward an understanding of what it is that you're writing. And if you can give yourself the luxury of blind starts, false starts, mistakes, a certain degree of energetic incoherence, the track record shows that eventually, you know, given enough time and patience and self-forgiveness, that you're going to be able to come back at this in various ways in revision and find out the form and the structure and the motifs that you need to lend a kind of recognizable continuity to it. This book came apart and was put back together several times over the course of the years that it took me to write. If you can keep from feeling panicked when that happens, you can write a book.
Are there other fragments or parts of books or things where you've started and you've hit a dead end but you want to come back to?
Oh, yeah. There's always stuff on the bottom of the closet that didn't make it into the final cuts of previous work. And sometimes you can remember, even after the passage of years, oh, my word, you know, there's something here that completely fits what I need. This set piece on Olivier Messiaen's A Quartet for the End of Time that occupies a portion of the early part of the novel was something that had been, you know, nagging at me for years and years, and I'm so delighted that my story of a much later composer was able to make room for that and to provide a kind of counterpoint for Peter Elson thinking about his own work and about the necessity of music in his own time.
That's the story of Olivier Messiaen in the camps during World War II.
Yes, the Quartet for the End of Time was composed in incredibly hard conditions in Stalag in Germany, where Messiaen was a prisoner of war, and extremely dramatic circumstances involving its premiere in that camp, with four beaten-up instruments in an extremely cold and, you know, frigid, drafty barrack, with the German officer sitting in the front row listening to this performance of this piece from another world.
There's also another set piece, which is Els participates in, I assume it's real, which is this giant John Cage being in the Midwest.
Yep. I lived for many years and worked at the University of Illinois, where I was a professor of creative writing before my retirement a couple of years ago, before my move to Stanford, where I now teach and work. Illinois has a long and illustrious history associated with the avant-garde musical composition. It's part of what Alex Ross called I think it was something like the I-80 avant-garde, the interstate that runs through these various campus colleges in the Midwest, where these incredible experiments were taking place. And Illinois was just a hotbed of musical experiment in the 60s. It was the site of the very first computer music lab, electronic music lab, and John Cage spent some years in residence there and produced such works as Music Circus and Harpsichord, the famous Be In, a musical happening that was a kind of exercise in very lightly scripted chants and noise and a blending of all kinds of musical experiences to broaden our sense of what it is that we're listening to when we listen and what our expectations are. Of course, as someone who had firsthand access to a lot of people who had memories of participating in these extraordinary events, I just thought, well, I've got to send Peter Ells to graduate school here at Illinois and have him be on the edge of this craziness. And to have him as a man in his 20s take seriously Cage's challenge that noise is music by its maiden name, and that what we really need to do is get away from this sense of controlling and get back to this sense of listening to the astonishment of the world.
This is an aside. I was the editor of the program guide here at KPFA in the late 70s into the 80s, and we had a program, the morning concert program, and it mostly focused on new music. And I would type and write all about these great composers, and then I would listen to it, and it would all be bloops and bleeps.
That was the challenge of the time. When you have an expectation of what music is it legitimate to simply want to be served up what you already know is music? Or does the composer have the right to say, I'm going to take you on a ride, I'm going to push you, and I'm going to push your ear? Well, it may be legitimate up to a point, and it may be illegitimate beyond that point, but that point is very hard to determine. And there may be great value in the discomfort of listening to something that seems like it's from another planet to you, because many times, and this is an artistic experience that anyone who has given himself to the challenge of art will recognize, many times the thing that sounds completely alien and impossible and inscrutable to you will, with the course of attention and focus, open up and turn out to be amazing and absolutely uncanny.
Richard Powers, did that happen to you?
It has happened to me throughout my whole life. The problem now, I think, and this is very much at the heart of Orfeo, at the heart of this novel, is now that we live in an age where all music is available all the time to everyone from anywhere, how can we find the concentration and the quiet and the focus and sometimes the solitude to find our way into something that's not familiar? This book is very much about the journey of expectation, the journey of commitment, and the changing style of music that presents a constant challenge to anyone who wants to go deeper. But it's also about just how hard it is to find focus and attention and concentration now in a world, and what that's going to mean for art that wants to go deeper and wants to go farther.
You know, these days we're all living as if we have ADD, which makes it extremely difficult to even focus on a novel, let alone on music of bleeps and bloops.
That's absolutely correct. And the sense that the novel has to become shorter, has to become simpler, has to become more accessible, pervades many parts of the industry. This reader expectation, with the almost perpetual, immensely entertaining, infinitely pleasurable, endless distraction that's presented by the digital age, places enormous challenges on any art and makes it that much more incumbent on that art to capture your imagination in novel ways. But I also wanted to make sure that Else doesn't become a kind of curmudgeon or a kind of dismisser of the new. That would be too horrific an irony to turn him from a proclaimer of the new into a dismisser of the new. And in fact, I allow him in his final attempt to turn this unexpected audience of notoriety into a last performance of challenging piece. I allow him to use technology in a surprising way in order to bring that performance off.
Also, toward the end of the book, he's more open to modern music, whereas as a kid, and this is almost the reversal of where we normally are as a kid, he's completely closed to rock and roll.
Yeah, I had a good time setting him in his adolescence, of course, the heyday of early rock and roll, his brother and friends and everyone that he knew already being on to this particular revolution. And he's not getting it. And I create this scene in which his brother actually binds him to a chair in the basement of the family suburban home and forces him to listen to, you know, the most exciting music of the moment. And Elsa's saying, oh, that's nice. You know, but it's kind of repetitive. I think Elsa's difficulty with radio music is that while he can hear and enjoy the immediate seduction of music that depends on high amount of repetition, what he really wants is music of development and contemplation and reflection, music that requires a kind of memory of material sufficient to hearing change. He wants music that unfolds and creates a kind of narrative forward motion. And that's the music that's hard to come by now. We're really surrounded by immensely seductive and pleasurable music that knows how to deal in instantly attractive sonority, but not so good at the music that requires multiple listenings to hear exactly how you got from A to B.
Well, I think also on some level that's a definition of Richard Powers' novels as well.
Yeah.
There's another element to Orfeo, which I'd like you to talk a little about, which is creating the sense of music, listening to music, having music affect you, writing music, only you're doing it in prose.
I did have this fantasy of being a composer when I was younger, and I do have a closet full of compositions that never had an audience. I also imagined when I was young and still in school that poetry might be my art form, because it's something that you can pursue as an additive or supplementary form of expression when you are immersed full-time in other demands. It's tougher to do, you know, a 100,000-word novel on your own. People do it, and they produce magnificent results. But I was interested first in sound and then in sense. And in many ways, my journey as a novelist has been an attempt to recuperate and rediscover the ways in which sentences are what they are, not just because of the dictionary definitions of the words that they're putting together, but the whole contour and sonority and rhythm and pitch of the words and phrases that readers are sub-vocalizing when they read the sentence on the page. For a long time, I have composed my books using speech recognition. And that's another way of bringing sound back into my composition process.
When you say that, what do you mean specifically?
Well, speaking into a computer and having it convert my speech into text. And that's a way of hearing my sentences out loud, the way in which my readers will hear them when they're retracing them on the page. And I find that you can create certain kinds of visceral and bodily responses inside the reader's ear by rhythm and sound and pitch when things are working well that supplement the kinds of emotional states that sentences are describing. So the key, of course, is to get all these things working together so that the emotions experienced by the prosody and the implications inside the sentence are actually supporting one another, and the reader can be in the emotional state that the sentence describes.
And then you go one step further, and you use that technique to describe music itself.
Well, and that was the great pleasure of this book, to be able to spend 5 years, all in all, going back through the landmarks of the 20th century, listening to them again in midlife, in my 50s, and to rediscover in them the passion that I heard in them when I was a young man, and then to hear them again in the quiet and slower tempo of middle age, and to see what lasts, and to hear the changes that my own life have brought in me and my perspective, and then to try to do what so many people say is ill-advised and impossible, to try to convert the pleasures of those sometimes startling sounds into prose. And to do that not only for existing pieces, I do that for the Messiaen Quartet, I do it for Mahler, Kinder Totenlieder, Shostakovich Fifth Symphony, Steve Reich's amazing small ensemble piece called Proverb, to pick out 100 years of transgressive music, music straining against convention, and try to put those pieces into prose, but then to create Peter Els's fictional repertoire, and to find verbal descriptions to describe pieces of music that are entirely imaginary. And it was almost as if, in creating a kind of youthful style for this man, a style of middle age for the man, a late style, I almost had to create the music first in my own head before I could begin to describe it and to give it a palpable and very specific description. And that was great fun. I gave the manuscript to the composer, Steve Taylor, who was a marvelous contemporary composer who works at Illinois. And he said, as he was reading the book, while it was fun for him to revisit the canonical 20th century pieces, he said, what I really want to do is hear these imaginary pieces. You know, and that was, to me, that was sort of a confirmation that I had created enough suggestive material to make these pieces live as musical pieces.
But, of course, you never did actually compose them.
No. Although, the book is being translated into German and should appear shortly in Germany. And one of the things that my editor there is doing, and it's a marvelous idea as a sort of promotion for the book, is to commission young German composers to actually create or to recreate, through my descriptions, passages of these works as a kind of imaginary sample of an imaginary literature.
Richard Powers, the decision to make the opera The Siege of Munster and parallel it with Waco, how did that come about?
I've been fascinated with the story of the Anabaptist uprising, the early 16th century cataclysm that resulted in the takeover of an entire large city in northern Germany. Since I visited Munster as a younger man when I was living in Europe in the 80s, it's such a dramatic story that it calls out. It's operatic in its own, you know, without tampering with history at all. In the back of my mind, I always knew that there was rich dramatic potential there. I work in an allusion to the uprising, the Munster uprising, in an earlier novel, Operation Wandering Soul. When it came time to actually look for a dramatic work that Els could create in conjunction with his longtime best friend, worst enemy, nemesis, Richard Bonner, this subject jumped out at me, because here was the story of a group of people who, through a kind of deranged act of collective imagination, decide to proclaim the New Jerusalem and to take over a real physical city, a functioning city, and turn it into a deranged work of art, a bizarre collective ensemble performance of the imagination, declaring that the world was entering into end times and the judgment was at hand and all the citizens of Munster would now have to kind of begin this marvelous, transcendental, and horrific performance of themselves as the creatures welcoming in the new kingdom of God. Well, this is so appropriate to the book in so many ways. I mean, one, Els is living in an America that is obsessed with its own eternal millennial fascination, the kind of Christian fundamentalism that has constituted in a way that he would never have expected as a young man, the texture of political discourse in the second half of his life. But it's also a subject that raises this question of the subversive quality of art, the danger, art as danger, and art as a revolution. And so to have this kind of play within a play, or a creation within Els's creation, and then to pair it, it happens at this moment where this story is recapitulated in astonishingly close parallel with the Branch Davidians in Waco.
Was that kind of a little light bulb going off your head in your head and going, aha, there it goes?
It's the kind of luck that an artist can feel that can almost make them think, well, maybe there is a divine plan. So I exploited this, and I actually used it to trigger Els's perpetual discomfort with the tension between an art of the mind and an art of the world, a political art, and his inability to take responsibility for an art that asks the world to change.
He is not ever, in this book, a revolutionary. He's never really looking at it from a political angle. You, on the other hand, Richard Powers, you are. And by bringing in Homeland Security and bringing in what the tracking devices that can be used, because he has to play a lot of games with cell phones, you're also bringing in this strange new world where we're being observed at all times.
Yes, I would say it is true that Els is the kind of composer who's more interested in the crises of aesthetics than he is in the crises of world markets or political public spaces. Even in the heyday of the 60s and 70s, he is on the sidelines politically and primarily concerned with an aesthetic revolution until, as an old man, politics comes to his door and provides him with the audience that was always lacking in his concern with creating this aesthetic art. So yes, this was my way into this world of perpetual surveillance, of security, that while I was working on the book, sometimes seemed to me perhaps ebbing, and that we were getting beyond our initial terror of the consequences of the act and starting to realize that no, political terrorists were not around every corner and under every bush and about to destroy the fabric of our society. And I thought, well, it'll be interesting to launch this book in the world, to set this guy as a fugitive, to make him incapable of checking out a library book or using a phone or running a credit card through a gas pump without worrying whether or not he's leaving a trail that's going to come back and haunt him. And I'll put this out in the world, and I'll see whether or not there's anybody who's willing to say, well, this is a valid concern, something we should all be watching. And as the book went into final production, all hell broke loose, and Snowden's disclosures about PRISM, which are still unfolding and will continue to unfold for a long time, other stories about the New York City police eavesdropping on religious services in mosques, William Volman writing this terrific piece in Harper's about the lifelong price that he's paid for having been a suspect, a Unabomber suspect, based on the creation of his own novels. All of this, I just thought, my word, I want the book to be out right now, you know, because, you know, here's the story, here's what I'm writing about. And I'm not so concerned about having to publish it right away, but I think this is a story that we're going to be living with for a good long time, and I hope it's one that art comes back to again and again in many forms.
Well, I suspect it will. One thing I noticed about Orfeo is that for all of Peter Els' concerns, the subject of the relation of commerce and art barely rears its ugly head, except in an occasional statement from his wife, his ex-wife, because he can't make a living.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if that would have been too kitchen sink to have that in, or whether you needed to focus, or because it must have been on your mind.
I guess, in Els, I'm creating that kind of artist who, and again, this is a function of when you're born, but he's of that age that is taught to believe that the marketplace is not the place where the true value of art is decided. And in a sense, there's a kind of moral obligation on the part of the artist to turn your back on the concerns of the commercial viability of your art as a referendum on the success or failure of your art, and to push that into a kind of completely ancillary place while you make your work. That's a strange kind of romanticism that lingered, that was certainly prominent in his generation, has lingered in, you know, into mine and beyond. I think it's probably a much stranger idea to people working now who are bombarded with an instant sense of the success or failure commercially of what they're doing, and a much broader willingness on the part of the public at large to equate that kind of success with the desirable success of the artist. But this other kind of ivory tower or starving artist kind of model that else brings, that sort of late romantic sense of having to do everything but work in your field in order to keep a roof over your head while you're doing the true work of your life. I enjoyed telling that kind of story because it's one that's still very much part of the texture of the artist myth that I was brought up on as well.
Richard Powers, in describing the book Echo Maker, someone said that it's about the cognitive construction of reality. And in looking at books like Orfeo, Generosity, any of your earlier works, I keep coming back to that phrase because what you're doing is you're looking at various ways in which the brain, because here we see music also from the perspective of the brain, how the brain and how we create the reality around us based upon who we are, I guess, how we've been raised.
I'm fascinated with this tangled, reciprocal, interdependent web of processes that we use to build up the real. And there is stuff out there, no question, that's beyond any of us. But what we do with that stuff is also the real. And this way in which the inside, the self, groups of selves, species create this telegraphed, constant stock exchange of swapping of representations, descriptions, as a kind of aggregate ensemble performance of the real. That very much interests me. And I think it's a much more robust and satisfactory way of describing how it is that we make our way through the world and in and through ourselves than a kind of naive empiricism that says there is an indisputable fabric of stuff that has nothing to do with our interpretation or our operation upon. And that's why the novel is such a great form for me, because it allows me to create complicated webs of the real, to distribute it among multiple people, to have different protagonists whose real has to collide and bump up and renegotiate in the hard act of moving through the world.
You said that this is a performance that's going on with all of us at all times, which on some level means maybe deep down our lives themselves, from your perspective, are art.
Beyond a doubt, the experiencing self and the remembering self are profoundly different things with profoundly different agendas. When I went back in the course of writing Orfeo and listened to these works of art that had been so important to me at 16, at 26, at 36, when I went back at 54 and 55 to hear them again, they were different. I thought something literally had changed in that piece. Of course, it was me who had changed. And the images of the pieces that I had brought forward into my life had altered because of the path that I was tracing. And it was marvelous, a marvelous reminder to me to remember that process, that unstable and constantly unfolding dynamic process of making yourself through re-experiencing things, creations of other people, the landmarks of the past. And this act of remembering as an active process, not as this kind of passive retrieval of something that once was, that's very much at the heart of the story of Orfeo, a man remaking his sense of what his life meant, what his music signified in the course of playing it again.
One final question. Richard Powers, have you begun work on another novel?
Always. And, there's a moment of satisfaction, a very brief moment, as any given book goes into production, where I think to myself, you know, gosh, that's nice. You've discharged your responsibility to the world. You can kick back now and enjoy yourself, travel, have fun, do whatever you want. And that lasts about a week or so. And then it's, you know, what have you done lately? The thing is, once you start making this life of artistic exploration and representation and rediscovery, you're on it for good. And the only thing that matters is continuing that process and doing it again. I'm doing it now. I've become obsessed with trees, and it seems a funny subject to write a book about, and yet many books have featured trees as a central component to their narrative. And once you begin to see them, you realize this is a massive part of the human world and the natural world that can be almost invisible until you make it the subject of its own story.
Remember interviewing someone who was telling me about how all the chestnut trees of the East Coast have died. I'm thinking, it wouldn't even occur to me.
Yeah, and not just chestnut. The elm would be another disappearing story. This is a tree that characterized my childhood and is now, it's more or less impossible to see a mature one. But there are also fascinating stories about the recovers of these trees. People who are right now engaged in producing resistant strains of these trees and reintroducing them into the world. And that has all the drama of a really compelling story.
You've been listening to an interview with Richard Powers, whose latest novel is Orfeo. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves.